Support for 51% comes from the Master of Arts in Teaching program at Bard College, offering master's degrees and teacher certification in 1 year, graduate study and extensive public school residencies combined with small class sizes, and a focus on the learner as an individual. Now accepting applications, teaching what matters. bard.edu/mat/ny.
On this week's 51%, we have another example of the gender pay gap, this time in academia.
And why doesn't that bother everybody? May I make that point to my husband? If I'm not getting paid what the men in the field are getting paid, you're losing household income too.
Hear about the call to have insurance cover donor breast milk and meet the CEO of Canyon Ranch. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Women are earning more degrees in higher education than men. So why are there so few women in tenure track or leadership positions in academia? Lilia Fukin reports.
Between 2006 and 2016, more than half of the doctoral degrees in the United States were earned by women. Women also outnumber men in the number of master's, bachelor's, and associate's degrees awarded. But there are still more women than men dropping out of tenure track positions. Here's why.
I think the problem is the way the institutions have been set up to move newly hired academics to tenure has not changed, I think, ever.
Diane Hodge is director of the School of Social Work at Radford University's Waldron College of Health and Human Services.
Most universities still maintain the 5 or 6 year minimum to getting tenure. There's no way to kind of get on and off the tenure track.
Diane Hodge writes about this as a contributor in the forthcoming book, Surviving Sexism in Academia. She says women are having trouble getting past the tenure promotion hump. For those women who do achieve tenure, they finally have that sense of stability and are able to perform their research under less pressure.
The problem of getting women to that point, though, is that it coincides almost exactly with a last chance for most women to start a family. And having children is not a quick production. It causes a lot of stress. Do I take care of, you know, myself while I'm pregnant? Do I take that nap? Or gosh, I've got to get this other paper in because if I don't, I might not get tenure.
When Hodge started her own family, she talked to older women and she asked them, how are you able to have children and be tenure track?
And they said, well, just don't have the third child because that one's the career killer. And I couldn't quite understand what they were talking about. You know, how was that the breaking point? But of course, as I had my children, and as most people have children, they realize that when you're outnumbered and the cost of daycare triples and these kind of issues, it's very, very hard to hang on past two children.
Hodge's recent study shows that there are still more women than men dropping out before achieving tenure. She says this has a lot to do with the age of people when they start out in tenure track positions.
At the least, you'd be in your late 20s, early 30s, and that would be considered young. For women, of course, that is prime childbearing age. And if you pass that up and wait till you have tenure, you could be pushing 40 years old. And of course, the ability to have children after 40 becomes much, much more difficult.
Hodge says women in the field also begin their careers at lower salaries than men.
It's a gap that doesn't seem to close ever. Our own recent study of our social work colleagues across the country showed that the average difference between white, non-Hispanic males and women at just about every level averaged about a $6,000 difference.
Hodge says it just doesn't make sense to compare salaries among women without recognizing that they're all getting paid a lot less than men doing the exact same work.
And why doesn't that bother everybody? May I make that point to my husband? If I'm not getting paid what the men in the field are getting paid, you're losing household income too. It's not just me.
Hodge says the glass ceiling in higher education is nothing new. But with women outnumbering men in academia overall, it's about time we pluck the glass pane out of its ancient frame. For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Lilia Fukin.
There's a reason donor milk is called liquid gold. The fluid can make a big difference to premature babies with underdeveloped digestive systems. But the cost is often prohibitive, around $4 an ounce at nonprofit sources, or as much as $30 an ounce from for-profit places. States are hard at work trying to figure out who pays for the milk, how much, and when. Karen Chakurji reports.
Oh, that's them. They're there.
The New York Milk Bank is small, spotless, and noisy. Two massive stainless steel freezers are humming along, and they're stocked with these little glass bottles of pasteurized breast milk. A deep freezer in the corner is filled with bags of milk waiting to be pasteurized. Julie Boucher-Horowitz, who runs the milk bank, welcomes in one sleepy-looking customer, a new dad.
Good. So what day of life is this? It's the second day of life?
Michael Guinan is picking up milk for his newborn because his wife isn't producing any yet and the baby is losing weight.
Got down to about 5 pounds, 11 ounces.
Every year in the U.S., about 55,000 babies are born early and very small. They're under 3.5 pounds. Their digestive systems can't really process formula easily, and they also benefit from breast milk for all its infection-fighting, immune system-building properties. But not all moms produce milk or enough of it. Estimations show that most of those tiny infants could use at least some donor milk.
Okay, so let's get the milk.
Nonprofit donor milk banks receive, screen, and process breast milk from moms who want to donate their extra milk. Those moms don't get paid anything. The bank then sells it to hospitals or families directly for about $4 an ounce. A full-term baby consumes, on average, 30 ounces a day. Nonprofit milk banks are making a comeback across the country. In 1980, there were 30 active banks in the U.S. Then, no insurance coverage, formula campaigns, and concerns about HIV transmission meant most of them closed. By 2000, there were only 5 left.
Pauline.
Pauline Sakamoto directs one of those 5 milk banks that stuck around in San Jose, California. In the 80s, her bank co-founded the Human Milk Banking Association of North America, a national group that formed to set standards for donor milk.
There was a lot of contention about adapting these really rigorous standards.
It took them 5 years, but they created guidelines by the 90s. Since then, the World Health Organization, a Surgeon General, and the American Academy of Pediatrics have all said in one way or another, for preterm infants, breast milk is better than formula. So when moms can't produce, donor milk is the next best thing. And Pauline Sakamoto says at least some of the healthcare community is paying attention to that message.
The research is bearing out what milk bankers have known for quite a long time, for the last 100 years, that there are reasons why this milk is gold.
In the past 4 years, the amount of donor milk distributed has doubled from about 2 million to 4 million ounces. Today, there are 26 nonprofit milk banks around the country, and 6 more are on the way.
5 other freezers.
At the New York Milk Bank, Julie Boucher-Horowitz basks in the amount of milk they've received so far.
So do you have more milk than you know what to do with?
Well, that's a good question, because we're new.
The bank has 7 freezers full of donated milk. Boucher-Horowitz is letting hospitals know that the bank is up and running. And now the question is, will hospitals jump on board, and who is going to pay for all of this?
She loves those elephants.
This music-making toy elephant is making Lucia Rojas, an 18-month-old little girl, real happy. Little teeth, huge, huge smile. She's standing up and doing a bob dance maneuver next to her mom, which is kind of a miracle considering how sick she was. Lucia was born 3 months early. She weighed 1 pound, 9 ounces. Mary Sarah Rojas, her mom, says doctors told her, let's see if the baby makes it through the weekend.
I think everyone was, like, really terrified. Everyone thought she would die.
Lucia had two surgeries in the first 2 weeks of her life. She spent 3 months in the neonatal intensive care unit at Strong Memorial Hospital. Doctors said breast milk would help heal her intestines, and the baby couldn't even digest formula anyway. Mary Sarah pumped and pumped, which was all fine, until her milk supply dwindled.
There were no other options. I couldn't, you know, bounce from one formula to another and just try and see, oh, does she like this formula? Does she like that formula? I didn't have that as an option.
Mary Sarah turned to a donor milk bank in Boston, which sells breast milk for $4 an ounce. A full-term baby consumes about 30 ounces a day. So depending on how much a family needs to order, that can be in the ballpark of $800 a week. The milk did cost the Rojas family a lot, half of her husband's annual income.
People have always questioned the cost, but when you think about the potential benefits, the cost really isn't a major hurdle.
That's neonatologist Jeffrey Myers. Researchers have found that premature babies who can't get enough of their own mother's milk do better with donated milk than formula. They have shorter hospital stays, lower rates of infection, fewer surgeries. It costs less for everyone. But even with this evidence, most hospitals and insurance companies do not pay for donated milk.
We wouldn't withhold an antibiotic from a patient who has an infection and we know that's the right antibiotic.
Myers runs the NICU at Strong Hospital in Rochester, where Lucia Rojas was a patient. Their center is the most advanced NICU in the region, but it doesn't routinely stock breast milk. It's more expensive than formula and requires a whole separate protocol.
We're oftentimes stuck using formula because we don't have another alternative.
He estimates 75 to 100 infants a year in his NICU alone could benefit from donor milk. Currently, 5 states and Washington, D.C. require Medicaid to pay for it. Boriana Parvez works at another advanced perinatal center in New York. She spoke directly with Medicaid officials about costs.
We also spend a significant amount of time trying to convince Medicaid that donor milk reimbursement should be outside the bundle code.
Bundled code. So when infants go into the NICU, hospitals are reimbursed one lump sum based on degree of sickness and length of stay. That is bundled payment. So to add something in means hospitals will have to eat the cost unless Medicaid pays for it separately.
Because otherwise the hospitals will not have incentive to provide donor milk.
For now, most hospitals and patients nationwide are figuring this out on their own terms with their own dollars. Karen Chakurji, Side Effects Public Media.
This story was produced by Side Effects Public Media, a reporting collaborative focused on public health. Just a note, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo at the end of November vetoed a bill that would have provided medical assistance coverage for the cost of donor breast milk that is considered medically necessary for certain prematurely born infants. The Obama administration is announcing its support for requiring women to register for the military draft. The administration has been deliberating for roughly a year about whether to back such a change to the Selective Service. White House National Security Council spokesman Ned Price says that because previous barriers to military service are being removed, it makes logical sense for women to be required to register for the draft. But Price says the Obama administration remains committed to an all-volunteer military. Under current law, women can volunteer to serve in the military but are not required to register for the draft. All adult men must register. It would take an act of Congress to add women to the Selective Service. The change in position was first reported by USA Today. Zuckerman first opened Canyon Ranch in Tucson, Arizona in 1979. Now there's a woman at the helm of Canyon Ranch, an industry leader in healthy living and luxury spa vacations, and this week's installment of the 51% segment Force of Nature from Dr. Sharon Ufberg focuses on Susan Dougherty, CEO of Canyon Ranch, where she has been since 2015. Her passion for wellness is matched by her business savvy. Before joining Canyon Ranch as CEO, Dougherty was the first female in General Motors' 100-year history to be appointed and hold a corporate officer title as vice president. She spent nearly 3 decades at GM. Among her many achievements with luxury automotive brands are launching such vehicles as the Chevrolet C7 Corvette and electric Volt, and conceiving, creating, and launching the Cadillac Escalade SUV.
Susan, what was your motivation to join Canyon Ranch's leadership in 2015 after so many years at General Motors?
Well, that's a great question, and I have to tell you, it's a long road from General Motors global headquarters in Detroit, Michigan, to Canyon Ranch in the foothills of Tucson, Arizona. The lessons that I learned along the way during my automotive career about building iconic brands, introducing them to the world, and connecting different cultures prepared me to lead Canyon Ranch as it expands its reach into the global wellness market. When I reflect on it, at GM, I had, many great jobs, but at Canyon Ranch, I've got a great mission. And I reflect on the fact that, a new car can provide the freedom of the open road. It can improve your life by providing transportation and allowing you to see the things you never thought possible. But it cannot transform, prolong, or save your life. And for nearly 40 years, Canyon Ranch has helped thousands of people from around the world discover the power of integrative health and wellness, giving them the tools they need to live longer, younger, and better.
So do you have any specific goals for Canyon Ranch now that you've taken the helm and have been there for, almost 2 years?
Yeah, one of my goals is that, this whole idea, of coming to Canyon Ranch and working in a wellness community has definitely made it much easier for me. And when I tell people this, they say, well, Canyon Ranch isn't the real world. It isn't a real workplace like General Motors. And I say, well, why isn't it the real world? The best practices of Canyon Ranch could transfer anywhere, even to General Motors. The byproduct would be healthier employees, fewer sick days, and much lower health care costs, and clearly, more profits. And what I think you'll find is it becomes a happier workplace as well. And also reflecting on this, I feel, wellness is good for business, and it is a good business. Wellness was $3.72 trillion in the 2015 calendar year and is projected to keep growing. People everywhere are desperate for wellness, but they certainly need more support.
I think it's so interesting that you've come to Canyon Ranch at a time where clearly it's beginning to expand to a global brand. I know that you're opening up a new place in Turkey, and I'm wondering how your experience in this global market, how it's really reflecting now on your work with Canyon Ranch.
Yeah, I need to pay credit to the team that I inherited. Canyon Ranch is certainly recognized as a worldwide leader and, as a mecca for healthy vacations and a place where people can really transform their lives. And what was most interesting to me when I arrived there was that 65% of our guests returned to Canyon Ranch, which is unheard of in the hospitality industry. And this whole idea of wellness vacations has become a very booming business and in its own international industry, as you've pointed out, and represents about almost $500 billion annually, the fastest growing travel trend today. Today, people understand wellness, they value it, and they're willing to invest in it. And you may ask, well, what price can you put on your health? And we all know it's priceless. And that is what our guests share with us almost on a daily basis. With respect to Turkey, it really has been an incredible journey. We opened up our destination resort, wellness resort, in Kaplankaya, Turkey, on July the 1st of this calendar year. And it has been, first of all, a great opportunity to be in the land of ancient healing and to be located in a place where East meets West. Our resort is on the edge of the Turkish Riviera, on the edge of the Aegean Sea, overlooking the Greek Isles. And this is our first opportunity to take Canyon Ranch out to an international destination and expose our brand to lots of different cultures. We're just at the beginning of this journey, but we're really encouraged by what we're seeing there.
So great. Sign me up. Sign me up for that one. I have to say, as a woman and someone who, you know, really rose to the top, and a very interesting story. I know you said you started out in a transmission plant working your way through college to being one of the top leaders, and as a woman, that's so inspiring to hear, you know, where you were in the automotive world. I know that even, you know, in the wellness industry, it must be, you know, very unique still to be a woman at the helm, and I'm wondering how you're, you know, being a woman, how that really affects your work and the role you play. I know you brought on another key woman as CMO, Kathleen Shea, and I'm wondering, you know, how you developed your global team, how being a woman distinctly makes a difference in that regard.
Yeah, well, first of all, with respect to my team, I couldn't be more excited, you know, to be bringing on new team members to Canyon Ranch as we grow internationally and globally. It's critically important that we bring in people who have had experiences with global iconic brands working in different places around the world, because understanding cultures and the diversity you know, in this space, as well as what the consumer's looking for on their own personal wellness journey, is going to be a key, an absolute key to our future success. But the other comment that I would make is that women absolutely lead the way, especially with their own families, on, you know, the whole conversation around wellness. You know, women, you know, embrace that and are anxious to get on their own personal journey for wellness. And when they do, they are actually the catalyst to bring men into that conversation as well. And interestingly enough, at our destination resorts, we find that 75% of our guests are women. And once they've had an opportunity to experience what preventative wellness can do for them, they are then so excited and charged over that that they share that conversation either with their spouses, their brothers, their fathers, sons, so on and so forth, and it enables them to be brought into the fold. And we find that when men want to get on that journey as well, they approach it with gusto and do exceptionally well.
So you said 75% of your guests are women, and that's across the board at all your locations or your spas that are connected to other hotels?
75% of our guests are women at our wellness destination resorts like Tucson, Arizona, Lenox, Massachusetts, and Kaplankaya, Turkey, which, you know, we're still at the early stages of opening up that property. And then, of course, Canyon Ranch is also present at sea on four luxury ships, Celebrity, Cunard, Regent, and Oceana. And on the ships, we find a better balance of women versus men, but it still does skew to women. Interestingly enough, one of the big trends for Canyon Ranch spas at sea is a big rise in acupuncture. We're finding that, you know, many of our guests are looking for acupuncture, and to be quite frank now, we're working hard to keep up with the demand. It's ironic. You wouldn't think that people who are on vacation would be, you know, interested in being stuck with needles, having those put into them while they're on a luxury cruise line. But I think what people are beginning to understand is the value that, you know, approaches like acupuncture can be a part of their wellness equation.
You mentioned to me that it's very interesting now at this stage in your career trajectory to really be working with a company that has such a strong mission. And I do think it's inspirational for other women who are working in a corporate structure to see that we can make choices where it's our role is very mission-driven.
Yeah, I think our challenge in the wellness industry is to make it easier for people to incorporate wellness into their overscheduled, overstressed lives and to create more communities that support and encourage wellness. And since women lead the way, especially with their own families, we've got to do more to support, educate, and inspire them.
Susan Dougherty from Canyon Ranch, thank you so much for being with us today. And this is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Ufberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in Napa Valley, California. She regularly blogs for the Huffington Post. Oh, and just a fun fact, in this season of perhaps holiday stress for some, Canyon Ranch has the world's largest day spa in Las Vegas on the Strip, and on a typical Saturday, more than 950 massages are given. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1430.